u voorstellen aan gerrymander. En één mededeling doen, namelijk dat de bulletins die links liggen bij de deur, die zijn gratis. Het ene boek For Arguments for the Elimination of Television is slechts een zichtexemplaar. En er zijn boeken nog te koop. Dus tussen de lezing en de discussie of daarna kunt u dat doen. Gerrymander is van plan om ongeveer een uurtje te spreken en daarna is er een mogelijkheid tot discussie. Dank u wel.
It's okay to move this up. Okay. So I'm very happy to be here. I'd like to thank D'Apple and Mickery Theater for bringing me. This is the first time I'm speaking about this book in Europe, in any European city at all. So it's my debut. And it's a really good occasion for me. Thank you all for coming. The technology is going to get in the way. you just keep away from it. I know that television here in Holland is in some ways different from American television, and that's going to be on everybody's mind, which is fine. It's also in some ways the same, and so we're going to find during the course of the evening what's different and what's the same, maybe. I mean, you'll all be probably thinking about that, but I know that despite the fact that most people feel that the Dutch television system and Dutch television programming is superior to American, I think that myself, and in fact I think most European television is superior to American television. Nonetheless, I know just from mail I get, my book has been published in a number of European languages, and I get a lot of mail from Europe, and people seem to have the same kind of gnawing concern inside themselves about it. People worry about it a lot, and people in America have worried about it for a very long time too, and it was because at a certain point I got very worried about it, and I felt not enough people were worrying the right way, and I just started to explore what it all meant that I wrote the book in the first place, so it's what got me into it. It was really watching my children watching television, which got me into it more than anything else. I have a technical problem here. Let's do it this way. But I know you all will have things to say, so I'm not going to speak for the whole time. I'll speak for maybe an hour or thereabouts, if people can last that long. And then I thought we'd be very informal after that. And I know some people in the room have read the book, and most people in the room have not read the book. And so I thought it'd be useful to first do a kind of overview of sort of the way I see the subject. I want to say that I'm not going to attempt here tonight to make the case for the elimination of television, or to explain all four arguments. Actually, the book is divided into four categories. It's actually got hundreds of arguments in it, but four general categories. And it's really not possible for me to reproduce all of that. The book took 5 years to write, and it's 400 pages long, and I went through many processes while I was writing it to understand more about what it meant. And I think it will relax everybody and it will relax me if we don't think that what I'm going to be trying to do here is by the end of 1 hour or 2 hours, whatever we have, that then you should either agree with me about the elimination of television or not agree with me about the elimination of television, because let's just wipe that out for the moment. I mean, that's my position, but let's instead just allow me to create a picture of how I see it and articulate some problems about it, some of which are specific to America, and others of which are also applicable to all television. And then after that, in the informal, afterwards we can all discuss and we can learn more about how you see the subject. I became interested in the subject, first of all, I don't know if you mentioned this or not in the Dutch introduction, but I was first of all became interested in television because I spent many years in the advertising business. And when I was in the advertising business, I was fascinated and very involved in the process of putting images out into a machine and seeing them reproduced in the world, seeing people behave according to the images that I put out. And at first, this was exciting and thrilling and amusing. And then it became sort of shocking to me, especially as during the 60s in the United States, so many people were arguing and taking to the streets about things that were happening in the world and a lack of information about what was happening. And the role of television seemed to be getting profoundly more important very suddenly in the 60s. I worked at that time with some environmental groups and some civil rights groups and some anti-war, anti-Vietnam War groups. And I noticed that in so many ways these groups were organizing their activities only for the media, that what had earlier been, especially in the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, some other movements in the United States, what had earlier been grassroots-based was now media-based. Organizations would mainly try to put their message on television. And the popular phrase at that time was that 30 seconds on the Walter Cronkite show, he's a big national news commentator in the United States at that time, 30 seconds on the Walter Cronkite show was worth more than a year's worth of organizing, a year's worth of political activity. And they were right about that. They weren't wrong about that. It was true. And that was what was a problem, because it meant that that activity in the States was increasingly only for the sake of its passage through the media to reach people, and an entire element of person-to-person contact and the possibility for real fundamental change was being passed by. You know, one thing would happen and people would understand it. If it got on television, people would then react to it. I don't know about understand it, but when another similar thing would happen, the civil rights, people became aware of the problems facing black people in the United States, but when the next issue would come up, the issue problem facing Indian people, for example, people would not take the message. They would not be able to apply from one issue to the other because they hadn't been through any thought process about it. All of this was just worrying me. And during the 60s, the only person who was really saying intelligent things about television was Marshall McLuhan, at least in North America. And most people couldn't follow what he was saying. They didn't understand what he was saying. He would say things like, the medium is the message. And people would puzzle about what that meant. Maybe Europeans didn't puzzle about it, but in America, people didn't understand what he was saying when he was saying the medium is the message. He was saying that the technology, the relationships it implies, the social changes it causes, the biological changes it may cause, as I think it does, the economic factors involved in it, the political factors involved in it, that is as important, or basically he was saying more important, than the information that was moving through it in the form of stories and content. So I didn't think much about that and didn't know what to make of that either, except I was having these experiences. And then I don't even know if you remember, was the Symbionese Liberation Army event publicized a lot in Europe? Did you all hear about that? It was a group of seven people calling themselves Symbionese Liberation Army, who then kidnapped a newspaper heiress and held her for Patricia Hearst and held her for a long time and so on. Well, that was, in a way, the kind of the final statement of that process, because the Symbionese Liberation Army, as far as I could see, was not an organization at all. It had only seven people in it. There didn't seem to be any other people connected to it of any serious consequence. They existed only in themselves, And all of their existence was only through media. Everything they did was, every one of their pronouncements was totally broadcast all over the country. And then, of course, they were, everyone sat and followed the story in the media, and then suddenly they were wiped out on television. They were blown up in their house on television, and then that story was over. And did that group exist, or didn't it exist, or was it real in the world, or... Anyway, then I was sitting in my office one day in the early 1970s, and I read, for the first time, the statistics about television viewing in the United States. And I'm going to repeat these statistics. They haven't changed since the early 1970s in the United States. They're about the same now. They haven't increased, but it's, as you'll see, almost a saturation point. Now, I always, whomever I'm speaking to, I always mention these statistics because, to me, if you want to understand the United States, then you've really got to relate to these statistics. They're really very important. And even though they've been sort of publicized, I mean, they've been in the newspapers in the United States, somehow people accept them and just pass them by and they don't give them the importance they really need to have. And let me mention some of these. And this was in the early 1970s is when this was achieved. That is to say, the wiring in of the United States took place from around 1960 to 1970, and by 1970 it was completed. So that 99.5% of the homes in the United States have television sets. The average home has the television set on for 6 hours and 20 minutes per day. Of course, you know, in the United States, it's 24-hour television. 95% of the population of the United States watches some television every day. That is to say, they don't go a day without watching television. The average adult person in the United States watches television for 4.5 hours per day. So the average adult watches 4.5 hours. The average child under the age of 12 watches 5.5 hours per day. Now, if the average person watches 4.5 hours per day, that means that the average person in the United States is spending more time watching television than doing anything else, except for sleeping and working or going to school. So you could look at the United States and say, and ask, what do Americans do? And the right answer would be the main thing Americans do is watch television. That's the main activity in the United States. And it's important to know that. It's also important to look at what the figures are here in Holland. I try to find them out, not real hard. But I have a feeling they're not anything like the American figures, but I'll bet they're a lot. I'll bet they, when you stop and think about what it means. So if the average person watches 4.5 hours of television a day, half the population watches more than that. That means you can think of half the people in the United States as watching more than 4.5 hours per day. So you can say that this is the first culture in history to have literally moved their lives inside the media. They live inside mediated life or secondary life, or they're living their lives as spectators to their lives, or spectators to lives which are supposed to be like their lives, but spectators to life. It's a kind of surrogate experience of life. It's replaced in many ways family life. It's replaced in many ways community life. It's become the wall in which people live. You know, it surrounds people's lives. Now, this is a very, very weird situation. If you were a Martian anthropologist in the recent Deapple, there was a long interview with a Martian, so I thought that was a good way of looking at this. If you were a Martian anthropologist circling the United States, trying to report back to Information Central or back to your planet on this culture, you'd have to say things like, well, they're all sitting in dark rooms everywhere. They're not talking to each other. They're separated from each other. They're watching a light. They're looking at a light. and the light is blinking on and off 60 times per second. And their eyes are not moving. There's less eye movement in watching television than in almost any experience in life, including dreaming. Your eyes move more when you dream than when you watch television. It's because of the size of the screen. And there's a relationship between eye movement and thinking. Eye movement is a sign of seeking information. So they're sitting that way, and they're sitting that way night after night after night, and their brains are in what we have measured as alpha, and I'll say more about that, which is a very passive, receptive, non-cognitive, non-thinking mode. This light is being sent to them from someplace where they aren't, very far away. It's going into all their homes at the same time, and that's the main thing they do. That's what Americans do. This is a very peculiar culture. Let's try to communicate with some other culture, not this one. Now, this light that we're speaking of course, is... the first time I heard those figures, let me go back a step here. The images that ran through my mind were like science fiction kinds of images. It reminded me of 1984, Orwell's 1984, or Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. Have people read that book, Fahrenheit 451, where life was basically lived in relationship to a wall-sized television set? All of life related to the television set. Books were outlawed. No books were permitted. The television set, after a while, got to know who you were and could speak to you by name. And your relationships were basically with the television set. And I think that that has definitely already happened in the United States. And the Reagan-Hinckley story, was the recent attempted assassination of Reagan by this John Hinckley reported widely in Europe? Well, I remember that was a kind of archetypal story to me to explain the a growing phenomenon in the United States, which is the people living in their images. People living strictly in images that they carry around without cognitive processes operate to the same extent. And I'll develop this as we go, but just to help you see how I see this, when I heard about this guy Hinckley trying to shoot Reagan, I didn't hear about it. I was buying some fish in a store and there was a television set on and I saw some reporters talking about this assassination, and they stayed on the screen for a long, long time. It was just them. There weren't any. They were just talking about it, but there weren't images of it. But I live about an hour north of San Francisco, and it's a very, very beautiful drive. I live in a town called Bolinas, and it goes through the mountains and along the coast. And I was looking forward to stopping on the beach on the way because it was a very, very beautiful day. And I was driving along the way and was going to stop at this beach, but I couldn't get this thing out of my mind. I couldn't get this image of Reagan and Hinckley and this event happening out of my mind. And there was this gorgeous day, and these beautiful birds were flying, and the ocean was there, and the beach. And I kept driving with this picture in my head. And I don't watch television very much, but whenever I do, I remember that the after effect of it, that you walk with the image in your mind. And it was happening to me at that moment. And then I started to really think about it and think about the story, or later on as I learned the details of the story. This Hinckley, who is apparently a crazy person, therefore living inside his own manufactured imagery anyway, had fallen in love with Jodie Foster, who is a movie star in the United States and whom he had seen in a movie. And in the movie, somebody does a spectacular act to communicate something to her that's covered by the media. Hinckley said that he wanted to communicate his love to this person who was just an image he had never actually seen in real life by doing an act in the world so she would know of his love. And so he shot the president. Now the president, which then she heard about. It worked. He communicated to her. The president, meanwhile, is a former actor. He spent 30 years making movies, and people always thought he was a bad actor. but he never had the right role before. So he's a person who spent his life being an image, that is to say, being an image for other people to see. And then he became president, and I always wondered whether he was being an image still. And there's some evidence of that, actually. If you read some interviews that he's had with people like Robert Scheer and so on, it really reveals the degree to which he is into the performance of president according to a certain script. That is the way he understands the role. And he's good at it. He's good at it in terms of understanding that that's the role that you take, your performance in the media is all that matters. And he's very, 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 very good in the media. He's very good on television. He's very good on the radio. And my hope is that he'll burn out like other TV shows. And there's some signs that he may be, because he's overdoing it a little. He's on all the time, and he's the same all the time. So it may get boring. I hope it does. But then suddenly this media person got a bullet in him. Now that's real. That's a definitely real thing that you have to relate to like a real thing. But when he was in the hospital, if you remember, I don't know how much this story was carried over here, but when he was in a hospital, what he spoke were lines out of comedies. He said, they asked him how he felt, and he said, "All in all, I'd rather be in Philadelphia," which is an old W.C. Fields line from the movies about 40 years ago. And it was funny. It was sort of charming, you know, that the man would be able to do that under those circumstances. And then he made several, I can't remember them all, but he did that 3 or 4 times. He gave lines right out of the movie so that when under stress situation, he performed a movie. Meanwhile, we all sat and watched this, you know, at home on our television sets. And, you know, and then it was over, and then came the Pope assassination show, and then came the Diana wedding show, and then came the Falklands War show, and people were just still sitting at home, you know, observing all of this, and ingesting all these images, and walking through the world that way. Okay, well, that was a long aside. But what I'm trying to get at is the weirdness of the situation. Now, getting back to the 1970s, I remember the first time I had that thought was when that same year, as I read those statistics, the Pentagon proposed to President Nixon at that time that all the United States television sets be wired so that they could be turned on automatically from the White House at any time through an electronic signal. In case of a national emergency. Now, I started to wonder what that national emergency might be, and I imagined that we'd all be asleep one night, and then 4 a.m., there, what's that light, and the television's on, and it's a national anthem, and there's President Nixon, and he informs us of a widespread conspiracy that we didn't know about, and the arrest of a certain number of people, and don't worry about it, everything's all right, go back to sleep. National anthem again, and back to sleep, and you wake up in the morning, and that would have been a coup that happened actually in everybody's head. It just would happen in everybody's heads all at the same time, countrywide. Well, that just revealed a potentiality, I think, that existed. It was later that I realized this was really a very naive way of looking at it, based upon my childhood memories of dictatorships and coups which took place, you know, sort of violent, you know, one a Hitler person leading a state, you know, a dictatorship model of that kind, or a coup d'etat model of a military sort. And, oh, by the way, the Pentagon then withdrew the proposal when it said that many Americans had misunderstood the purpose of that system. So, but I was realizing that this was a naive idea that a coup in the United States would take place that way, because some new statistics were published around that time which showed me that the coup had already happened. It wasn't going to happen. It had already happened, except it was a soft coup. It was a coup that nobody noticed because it had no big brother on top of it, or no single leader. And let me give you some more statistics, which I'm sure you have never heard, which nonetheless are available in trade publications in the United States, which is that in American television, 85% of national television in the United States is paid for by 100 corporations. Now, sometimes people don't think that's a very shocking statistic, but I want to point out that there are 450,000 corporations in the United States. There are several million businesses of one kind or another, and there are 250 million people in the United States. And this, we're speaking of 100 corporations. These people make drugs, chemicals, cosmetics, packaged foods, cars, and they're involved in oil and extractive industries. And there's one or two other categories that I forget. So, and they may all be selling different things in terms of their product, but the thing that they're selling is a way of life. They're selling a concept. They're selling a way of being in the world that equates with commodities. They're selling commodity life. And they are the only buyers in television because other people can't afford it in national television in the United States. A 30-second spot on national television in the United States costs $150,000 during prime time. So who can afford that? We all couldn't get together and chip in and buy one $150,000 spot, probably. Or if we could, we could do it once and put our spot out there for 30 seconds and that'd be it. You know, we'd have to save up for another 20 years to do it again. And the corporations do it, and then they do it again a few minutes later, and they do it again a few minutes later, and then 10 times the next night, and so on. The average American watching television in the United States sees 18,500 commercials per year. 18,500 commercials per year. If you multiply out that 4.5 hours by the number of commercials per hour, you get 18,500 commercials per year. Now, these same 100 corporations pay for most of what's called in the United States public television. There is a public television system in the United States which is so-called free of advertising, but about 45% of the public television system is paid for by these same corporations, and they do get to have a little tiny message at the very end of the programs. They don't interrupt the programs, but they get to have a message at the end. So it's advertising, but it's subtler kind of advertising. So you have to think of television in the United States as it presently exists as a private medium. It's a private medium in the hands of the largest corporations in the world interested in selling a certain kind of life, and they're the only people who can afford it, and they're basically the only people who can use it. Now, sometimes I get criticized for this book because it seems to some people to be an elitist argument, which is to say you want to take people's televisions away, which I really don't want to do, as though, and then they say, it's a people's medium. And you hear that a lot on the left. On the left they say it's a people's medium, you know, because everybody is wired up to it. But in the United States and in everywhere, actually, it's no people's medium. It is a medium for whoever controls it and reaches everybody. In the United States, it's corporations at this time. There's a reason why the corporations like television so much. They like all the other media also. They also dominate a great percentage of radio advertising, local broadcast television advertising, print media advertising. Every form of advertising is dominated, gets at least 50% of its money from these same 100 corporations. But they liked television especially, and there are many reasons why. And I think they are applicable to all discussions about television, whether you're in the United States or wherever you are. And that relates to the power of the medium. For corporations, it's not only they can reach everyone at the same time and speak to everyone at the same time and therefore gain a tremendous efficiency in the delivery of their message, but there's also something about the way the message goes in or the way television is received by people, the nature of the human television interaction, the thing that happens between the wall socket and the eyes and the brain and the cells, excuse me, that reveals a lot about why television so often falls in the hands of people who are interested in power, that is to say, corporations, military, and governments, usually, is who is behind television in almost all countries of the world. So I want to say something about some of the elements of power on television, and you can sort of extrapolate and apply it to Holland. How long have I talked so far? Half an hour. I first got interested in what you might call the power. Usually I looked at the relationship of the power of television to the fact of its reach, the fact that it could reach everybody. And then I thought of, well, I won't get to that. The first time I started to think about how it affects people biologically, or how images work, was while working on the book. There was a lot of publicity about the book appearing from time to time because it was a former advertising man writing a book about television. It was like an ex-CIA agent or something, exposing the company, you know. And so there was a lot of stories appeared from time to time. And I got a lot of mail, and people would come up to me and tell me a lot about television. People would want to talk to me about television, and they'd say, did I know that, and do I realize that, and am I covering this and that? And after a while, I started to keep notes because what people had to say was very interesting. And over again, I realized that what people were saying was the same kind of thing. People would almost always use the same kind of terms to describe television, describe their experience of television. They'd say, you know, when my kids are watching television, they look like zombies. I think television is hypnotic. I think it's mesmerizing. They'd say these things, and then they would laugh. They'd say, you know, I think television's hypnotic. Ha ha. Or, you know, I think television's a drug and I'm an addict. Then they'd laugh. And I realized that people didn't want to trust what they were saying. They didn't believe what they were saying. They didn't believe in their own observations until science or somebody had said that this is actually what's happening or made a study of it. But after hearing so many people saying this kind of thing over and over again, after a while I began to think, well, maybe they're describing something real. Maybe these are not just ways of speaking, but what they're describing are physical symptoms. They're describing things that are happening in their bodies to them. And that would be very important if night after night after night, everybody in the country is sitting in dark rooms, not talking to each other, gathering in images, and If something more serious was happening to them, then we ought to know about that. And I started a big investigation. I hired two researchers, and we went to computers, and we also did hand research to try to find out whatever had been studied in science about the biological relationship to television. And what there was only things like information about X radiation, which at one time had been a big problem, and which is less of a problem now. And so there were quite a lot of reports on X radiation. There was also a lot of reports on a condition called television epilepsy, where people prone to fits will sometimes have them watching television. But other than that, there was very, very little on what happens in the mind. There were a few, however. And I also did some interviewing, and the few reports that there were tended to be about, oh, there were articles by hypnotists which described television in night after, you know, sitting in dark rooms, staring at a light, flickering light, was something like a hypnotic induction kind of arrangement. But there were also some people who were studying brain waves. And the brain wave, you know, the condition of your brain when you're watching television. And they all agreed, everyone who did that study, agreed that if you're a heavy television viewer, for the longer you watch television, the more your brain is an alpha. The longer you sit watching television, the more likely your brain is to be an alpha. It goes in and out, but it's for the most part in alpha. Now, many people think alpha is good. If you meditate, as some of you probably do. Meditation teaches you how to get into alpha. Meditation seek to get into alpha if you meditate, because what that state is a slow, steady brainwave condition. And what happens is that your mind basically becomes open and receptive. And when you're meditating, what you're doing is allowing your mind to calm itself so that you can refresh it with your own imagery or from sensory information from the world or something. When you're watching television and your mind gets clear like that, you're not refreshing with your own imagery. They are putting imagery in, and you are in a completely receptive condition to that imagery. The best material on this was by Australian National University, which did a very long, interesting study about television reception. And basically, they said that television as an aid, it was for the Australian Educational Service or whatever it is. They said that television learning is tantamount to sleep teaching. That when you're learning from television, you're basically receiving the information without participating in the reception of the information. For example, when you are reading a book, you're not in alpha. You could not read and be in alpha, because reading is a cognitive... We've all read a passage of a book, and realizing we hadn't read it because our mind had wandered or something had happened, we have to go back and read it over again. You have to read it a second time or a third time to get it, to figure out what it's saying. And what you're doing when you read it over again is you're putting yourself in a cognitive mode, which you have to be in when reading in order to receive the information and process it well. When you're watching television, it's the opposite kind of experience. You're in a situation where you're sitting quietly, there's no stimulation in general, the screen is flickering, as I've said, the signal is being formed in the lower right brain. You know, a television signal is gathered over time by the series of dots and scans, and you form the image inside your head in your lower right brain, where dreaming is also formed. It's the same part of your brain. And it's a repetitive signal, that is to say, it's of the same density, so it's not stimulating. But the most important thing, I think, is that when you're watching television, you are watching a stream of images. The images come at their own speed. You have no control over the images. They come, they change, they move around quite a bit, and I'll describe that in a few minutes. Your choice is only to sit and receive them, or to turn off the television set, or leave the room, or do something else. But if you're going to watch television, you have to pretty much subject yourself to the rhythm of the machine. Now, when you're reading, for example, it's a completely different process. Reading is a very participatory medium, because you can go over a paragraph again if you wish, you can underline it, or write in the margins, or tear out the page, God forbid, or make a copy of it, or keep notes on the side. Show it to a friend, you can discuss it as it's happening. It's a very participatory system, and radio is in other ways more participatory. Your images are operating, but I don't want to jump ahead here. But the Rose Goldson, also a very good writer about television, who talks a lot about this process of the way information is received, calls it mnemonic learning, M-N-E-M-O-N-I-C. It means also learning without participation in the process of learning. It's information being received. The receptor is a receptor. Now, of course, you can see something on television and say, no, that's not true, that didn't happen. Then you wake up out of alpha, you're participating. But for the most part, you are in this receptive mode. Otherwise, you couldn't watch television. You have to do that. You have to do that. So, night after night after night, people are sitting in these dark rooms, not talking to each other, separated from everything, watching these images over a long period of time, or watching this light, and they're in a passive receptive mode, and they're being spoken to by a handful of people. So that gives part of the arrangement here. But the part that I want to talk about a little more than that is, and I know we have a lot of artists in the room, so I wanted to emphasize this part, and I don't usually try this, but I think I can do it, is to talk about imagery itself. That is to say, the power of the images themselves, and the way the images, how the images affect people on the receiving end. I know many of you are working with images, and I've seen some examples. I thought the current cover of Da Apple, for example, was a really fascinating sort of commentary on this, some of these things I'm saying. But while people are in this receptive mode, what they're doing is gathering images. Now, sometimes when I speak, I don't know if this will apply to anyone in this room, but sometimes when I speak and attempt to talk about images, there are people in the room in America, there's a whole school of psychology which says that images, that people don't even have images. And there are a lot of people who aren't in touch with their images, aren't in touch with the fact that they carry images around. So in case anybody has any doubts about that, let me just ask you all to think of your mother or the room that you sleep in or a member of your family. Now, what you've got in your head is a picture. So you've got an image. Now, I've never run into anybody who couldn't do that. And I believe you probably all could do that. So that's just proof of the point that you have an image in your head. So if anybody doubted that, which some people do. Now, images come from everywhere, of course. It comes from everything you see. And it also comes from your own thinking process. But now, in the United States, and increasingly in all parts of the world, and television is certainly very, very important in Europe, television is the major source of imagery. If people in the United States are watching 4.5 hours per day, which is more than they do anything but work and sleep, sleep is a, you know, personal imagery system, although one of the things people complain about is that they dream television quite a bit now. And work is repetitive imagery. It's imagery that you have repeatedly day after day, so it's not stimulating imagery. The main experience of new images is television to Americans. That's the main source of images. Now, I know it's a tricky statistic in a way to do this, but if the average person in the United States is watching 4.5 hours of television per day, then that's 4.5 hours they're not producing their own imagery, and 4.5 hours they're getting somebody else's imagery in. So the net change, the net transformation that's taking place, I believe, is 9 hours. So the right way to look at it, I think, is that for the time that people are watching television, they're sacrificing their own internally generated imagery, and they're receiving imagery from somewhere else. And we have just, where they're not, which doesn't relate to their lives for the most part, and which is in the hands of the people it's in hand of. So we have images. The biggest source is now television. The transformation is astonishing, 9 hours worth every day. We have to, I guess, allow then a 28-hour day. But anyway, it's the bigger percentage. Another thing about images that it's important to remember is that they're permanent. They don't go away. If I say to you, who can I say to you? I always say people in the States. Who's this TV guy, Vanden Heuvel? Is that his name? If I say, what's his first name? Art Vanden Heuvel, about whom I read an article just the other day. Can you all picture him? I bet you didn't know you had him in your head, you know. You've got him there. Now, if I say, erase Vanden Heuvel, can you do that? I doubt it, especially by the way I said it, which was to repeat his name again. But if I now say, atomic explosion, or say your mother again, or the room that you sleep in again, then I can put another image in there which will replace the image that you just had of this guy. But the only point that I'm trying to make is that you've got his image in you. Now, you've got all your images in you from all your whole life. It's not that you have that image and you don't have other images, but it's just to show that you've got that image, and you've got commercial images, and you've got other television people, and they're all living in there together with all your other images. And now television is such a major source of image that it's just worth noting that that inventory of images is living inside, and that you can't get it out either unless you're a very special person. I can't get mine out. Another thing about images, and it's a thing I learned in the advertising business, is that images are not resistible. You can't say no to an image. If you see it, you've got it. Now, advertisers know that because friends of mine are always saying that advertising is not affecting them. They ignore advertising. It doesn't have any effect on them. And I know the way advertising is in Holland, it's easier to avoid it, which is great. But if you watch it, you've got the advertisement in you anyway, and it's important to realize that 90% of advertising, at least in the United States, and I just saw a little, about how many did we see last night? 6 ads last night on television here. They look pretty much the same. 90% of television ads in the United States have no content. There is nothing that you would say. These people are saying they don't get absorbed by the ad because they know it's fooling around, they know it's not real, they know it's just fake imagery and stuff. But the advertisers don't care that they know that. The advertisers are not putting anything concrete. The advertisers are just putting in images. That's all they're putting out is images. There's nothing in most ads, and it's probably true of television in Holland. If you watch, the next time you watch and you see some commercials, ask yourself where the content is, where there is a statement of fact that you can say yes or no to. You can say wrong or right. There's hardly any in American advertising, and they're correct to do it that way from the point of view of selling things, because they don't want you thinking about the quality of the product or getting into that realm at all. It's much more efficient for them to just put an image out which is, you know, nice, favorable, which does them, which presents them in a nice light of some kind, and emphasize the image, and we'll see used amazing technical tricks to increase the power of the image. They're not dealing in whether you agree or disagree with it. They're just putting the image in you. And then the more of those hits that you get, the more inside their image you are. And then you walk in a store and there's the thing that they advertised and there's a memory of it that you then have. And it's like an internal billboard that you can carry in your mind for the appropriate trigger. Doesn't mean you'll buy it. Does not mean that you will then buy the thing. But it's a numbers game that's being played. And the more of it that they do, the more likely you or the next person will do it. And anyway, the more you're inside commodity life, the more you've learned to equate your satisfactions with commodities, the more they've intervened in your personal satisfaction mode and given you commodities instead. So, images are not resistible. Another thing about images is that, and I think this is a tragic fact, and I don't even know why it's so, but I just ask if you are going to disagree with me about this. In my experience, it seems to me that artificial images, that is to say images which are manufactured, like on television and in movies, are more powerful than images that you yourself come up with. That is to say, they will overcome your own image. And my own examples, and I wish I had some European examples, I couldn't think of any, but I suppose that many people have read Gone with the Wind, or at least know about the book Gone with the Wind. But I remember the first time I had this thought is when I read Gone with the Wind, and there's this fabulous character in that book, Rhett Butler. And while I was reading the book, and as you read any novel, I was imagining this character. I had a very worked out character. He was he had definite qualities, he looked a certain way, and so on. Then I saw the movie, and Rhett Butler became Clark Gable. And I could never get my Rhett Butler back again. I could never come up with my own image again. The movie image had wiped out my own image. The same thing happened with Moby Dick. Read Moby Dick, and I had an image of Captain Ahab. And then Gregory Peck played Captain Ahab, and I've never gotten Captain Ahab back again either. And I'm sure you all have your own examples. Have people read the Castaneda books here, the Don Juan series about, has that been published in around here? No? Well, those who've read those books know that it's about a very amazing Indian named Don Juan, who Castaneda describes in tremendous detail. And Castaneda, for that series of books, was offered a fortune of money for film and television rights, maybe one of the highest offers ever for film rights and television rights for a book. And he has refused it all along and still refuses it. And then was quoted recently in a magazine as saying that the reason he refused it is that he didn't want to see Don Juan turn into Anthony Quinn. And I thought that was very smart, you know, that most novelists don't realize what happens to their, to the images that they have created. They basically, the filmed image is an alternative imagery system. It has nothing to do with what they created. Okay, so we're still talking about images. Another important point about images, well, so the summary of that one is that the artificial image, I believe, for some reason, can dominate a personally created image. I don't know about a personal image, like a me. I mean, if you see me, and then I was on a television set here, I don't know whether the television set image with me here too would dominate, probably wouldn't. But whether you see me and then go home and see this thing on television again tonight, I'll bet the television image would dominate your memory of me. I just think it would. Another item about images is that human beings imitate images. A way that children learn is, and if there are any teachers in the room, or if you have children, you know that when your children have watched some program on television, they will then go behave like that program. This is normal. This is the way children have always learned. This is a basic way of learning, is that people imitate their environment. They learn from their environment, and if their environment is television, they then learn from it, and they imitate what they see on television, and they become the characters that are shown on television. Well, the effect of that, though, is if and I think adults do that too. I mean, adults also pick up the language and behavior and style of certain kinds of characters. Whole fashion crazes will take place depending on what has been on television. People will all carry that image around. Well, what you get, what the result of that is, you know, with television as expanded as it is now in the States and seems to be very popular here too. It's a cloning process that's taking place. It's like everybody's walking around with similar kinds of images. And if they're beginning to imitate the images or see the world through the images or spend their lives talking about Dallas, what lately has happened on Dallas, and relating to their lives through the images, then what's happening is that you get an entire population living the same image. Now that's the ultimate autocratic arrangement. You know, it's so subtle by comparison with Big Brother and some of the others, but that is a pure autocratic arrangement. It's turning everybody out. I've begun to call it the cloning of the already born. You know, it's the way the people who've been born slightly different get to be the same by ingesting all the same kinds of imagery. Now another thing about imagery, and then I'm almost done with images, you may be getting bored with it already. Anybody bored with that yet? No? Is that artificial imagery, dead images are more powerful than live images, or can be more powerful than live images. Now I first learned this when I was doing some publicity work for the Sierra Club, which is a big environmental organization in the States, and I was at that time doing publicity work for them, and they were about to, the loggers in Northern California were about to cut down the last huge redwood forest in Northern California. Now, if any of you have ever seen a redwood tree, it's an astonishing experience to be in the presence of a redwood tree. You know, it's huge and it's awesome, is what they say. You know, it's got a tremendous power just being near it, and they grow in certain ways that they form a circle when they grow, and if you go inside that, it's a very powerful experience. And so when doing publicity for the Sierra Club, I decided that what we would do is do beautiful television photography of these redwood trees that are going to be gone someday. And we went out there and we did this, and we got it on the television news, although they resisted. They said it wasn't very interesting images. But they were right. It wasn't very interesting images. Because when it went on television, it didn't work. It didn't work on television. It lost something. And later on, I read, I began to realize, I'm referring to Walter Benjamin's article about the loss of aura in the reproduction of art mechanically. I realized I could apply that to that situation, which is that what's lost in the image of the redwood tree is the life of the redwood tree, that the translation of the image eliminates the life and leaves only the image. eliminates the pictures, eliminates that thing that you feel when you're in its presence. Now, then we went back and decided to take photographs of an area where the trees had already been cut down. And we did that and brought them back on television. Everybody got very excited about that. That worked much better because there was no loss in that imagery. You weren't losing anything in the when you were showing something dead. You were getting 100% efficiency. The thing that makes you care about the living thing on television is, you know, you lose something with the living thing. Now, this also has applicability to advertising, because with advertising, you take a dead product and you give it life. It dances, it sings, characters run all over it, you see it do its whole trip in 20 seconds. You add life to a dead thing in advertising, and meanwhile, living things are losing life, so you could say that television imagery is basically more suitable to advertising. It's a better medium for advertising than it is for life, and it's also a better, it has more possibility for communication. There's a greater efficiency of communication with dead imagery than there is with live imagery. Live imagery always loses something. Okay, now coming to the end of this imagery part, and I think I must be nearly an hour now, right? Nearly an hour, okay. I'll go about 10 more minutes, I think. Another important thing about imagery is that people believe their images. That is to say, when you see something, you believe it. Seeing is believing. Now, it would have to be that. And it's a very significant fact when you add it up with all the other effects of imagery, you know, that we've been talking about. Human beings, for the whole history of human beings until four generations ago or three generations ago, always would believe what they would see. If you saw you had to. That's your relationship to the world was a sensory relationship. That's how you gathered your information. There weren't mediated imagery. There wasn't artificial imagery, unless you want to count wall paintings or paintings or images that were created from books. But the way I look at it is that if you saw a thing in the world formerly, you could count on that thing being there, that it was really there. If you saw birds flying south and you saw them flying over your head, you'd say, those are birds, they're flying south, I can see them. I know that they're there. And you can you have to depend on that being true, that they're really there. Now we've been moved into a world where the images that we see on television and in film, and the more you watch, the more you see of it, are not there in the same way. They are there. The images that you see are there, but they're not reliable in exactly the same way. And I'll try to articulate the difference here. They've been changed in many, many ways, or they're different in many, many ways. First of all, technically speaking, the images are doing things that couldn't possibly happen in real life. They're, you know, you're cutting, images are being, you know, first I'm here and then I'm outside, I'm moving closer to you, I'm moving further away, my voice is separated from my image. Sometimes cartoons will rise, be in front of me. Music may rise while I stand here. I may whirl around. Well, now, if I did any of those things, if I started whirling around, you'd pay a lot of attention to that. And that's why it's done on television. You know, that's why images are fooled around with. Now, this is an artistic process. People attempt to create images that are more interesting than a just static image of just a camera facing an ocean, watching the waves crashing. Nobody would watch that for very long. So in order to watch television, the images have to be altered in that way in order to gain interest. But the interest is technical interest. It's not content interest exactly, but it's technical, and it's also the technical becomes the content. So it's sort of both. But it's real different from the birds, which are flying at real time at their own speed. Now, also about the images, is that there's a mix of image information, and last night some people were talking about this that I was with. There's a mix of information in television images or in movie images. You get so-called real programs or real things that are really happening, such as a news show or a live report on something that's actually going on while you watch it, even though the images are cut and the cameras are moving and you switch to this part of it and that part of it, which you couldn't do if you were there. Then right after that so-called real event, there might be a fictional program, which is to say, it could be a program that it's about real life, but it's a reenacted program. There are actors acting in it. And then you have a docudrama, which is an amazing new phenomenon in which there is a realistic recreation of something that formerly happened. It's a historical show, but it's happening as though it happened then. But it's really actors doing it, and they're recreating the lines that people supposedly might have said then. And then, of course, there's advertising, and there's all kinds of imagery within advertising, cartoons, and real personalities paying other kind of people, and completely fictional, you know, mix of images. And then there's sports. Now, I've never been able to figure out whether sports is a real thing or it isn't a real thing. I mean, it's happening, actually, and it's an entertainment, and it's happening, but the whole thing is a manufactured thing. I don't know. I never know what to say about sports. But the point is that all of these things are being pushed in together in the same image stream. You're still sitting there in your room, and different categories of information are coming to you, and they're also being rearranged in very spectacular kinds of ways. If in the average commercial, you'll see a rearrangement of the image, a thing done to the image that couldn't happen in real life, about 10 or 12 times in each commercial. Something will happen that's called a technical event that couldn't possibly happen in real life. In commercial programming in the United States, that happens about 8 times a minute. And in non-commercial program, because they don't have the money, it happens less. But it's a tremendous amount of hyperactivity in the image that's going on. Now, you can't rely on that. We are not trained to make, so far, we have to hurry up very fast to be able to change ourselves from looking at birds flying south and saying that we really see them and knowing that we can rely on that, to seeing images which are fooled around with in thousands of ways, and we rely on them to the same degree, or people tend to rely. No, there are studies to prove, this is one that has studies. In the United States, it's been studied extensively by some very good people named Gerbner and Gross at the University of Pennsylvania and others to show that basically Americans believe everything they see on television. That's to say, if they see a situation comedy about a family, they believe that that's, they don't believe that it's actually a real family, but they relate to it as if it was a real family, and they take the situations that are in the show as true to life, as applicable to their own situation. So there's a tremendous amount of acceptance. Now, another thing is that Gerbner and Gross have shown that that the view of the world is adjusted by the degree to which a certain view has been presented on television. For example, in America, American television, Americans think that the world is a more violent place than it actually is. Now, America is a very violent place, but the television image of America is much more violent than the actual America is. I mean, more violent acts, you know, 15 or 20 violent acts will happen on a normal evening of television watching. And then the average person who you ask in the world, and you ask about how much violence is there, and you give them a ratio of amount of violence, will overestimate by just about the amount that they see on television. The same will go for working people, you know, working class people in the United States, of whom there are vast numbers. They're estimated very, very low by people who watch a lot of television because they're not on television in the United States, or very rarely are on television. Same goes for women in offices, women in executive positions. There are more women in executive positions than are shown on television, and therefore Americans think there are fewer women executives than there actually are. So it's just a way of showing that people will gather in all of this information, and you know, they're sitting in dark rooms night after night after night, and they're not thinking anyway, and here we have the system of moving images into them, and it's a believable system. Maybe I'll do something I don't usually do, which is read a short. I was thinking it might be appropriate here, so I marked it. a short little thing from a conversation I had with a kid, because this all relates to this question of real and not real on television. You know, people are always asking, how do we make television more real, or people don't really accept it as real, or the question of what is real on television is a very important question. It's hard to understand, and people are always making assumptions about it. And there's something about this conversation that I really liked. We believe the news is real, fictional programs are not real, sports events are real. Let me skip here. Talk shows are real, or it's true they happen. Let me just go to the interview. As I write these lines, my son Kai is 7 years old. He's 15 now, actually. That was 8 years ago. He still asks me if the Bionic Man, do you have the Bionic Man in Europe? A definitely fictional character in a definitely fictional story is real or not. I remind him that the week before he asked me the same question, and I told him that the Bionic Man was not real, that he is an actor, that the story is made up, and so on. Isn't that a person on the screen, he asks. Well, yes, but he leaps around, throws cars, and so on. Humans can't do that. But couldn't somebody do that? Couldn't they invent something so people could do that? That's a dangerous question. He likes being less human, the idea of turning into a machine. The line of inquiry goes like that. He asked me questions about other programs as well. Are the quiz shows real? Yes. Are they happening now? No. When did they happen? I don't know, maybe a week ago. Do they really win those prizes? I think they do. Is Cotter real? Now, there's an American program on television called Welcome Back, Cotter. It's about a teacher in a classroom situation. Is Cotter real? Is that a real school? No, Cotter is an actor. The kids are actors. You mean those kids don't go to that school? There is no school. That's television. That's a studio. What's a studio? It's a place where they make up scenes to look like they're real, but they're not really real. They're all playing parts. There are loose ends in this explanation, because they are images of real people on the screen, and they are often doing logical, amusing, and interesting things. It's difficult to get at exactly what I'm talking about. After all, there it is. Those are real people. It's really happening. It is real. When Kai is watching television, he's watching people doing things, and they are doing them. It's the same as the South Flying Birds. He is right. The things that he sees on television are real. It's just that they're made up real. That's what I'm trying to tell him. But that's very, very subtle. It's difficult to communicate, and it's difficult to understand. It's even difficult to talk about here. And what you're left with as a parent, then, if you want to have a kid making distinctions in life and not getting totally caught by television reality, is you have to develop what you might think of as sensory cynicism. You have to teach the kid not to believe the information from the senses. You have to tell the kid you can't rely on your senses anymore. It's all over. Now you've got to use your head. You've got to work with your brain constantly. You've got to keep your brain observing everything that's going on, and don't let them fool you. And you've got to keep making categories and keep saying, this is real, this is not real, this is cameras moving, you know, the screen is flickering, you've got to stay awake. And you have to develop that kind of receptive mode, or television increases its power. So that's a crappy choice to have to make, I think, to have to make that choice. And I've had to make it in my life. And I feel terrible about it, you know? I feel terrible about having to go through that process with the kid. Now there's no television, or almost no television, and it works out better. But, so, to summarize the imagery part, to try to bring it all back together, people are sitting in these rooms night after night after night, like the Martian sees, and they're all wired together, and they're all receiving similar kinds of images, and they're in a semi-awake state, they're in a totally receptive state. The information that's coming to them in the form of images is suppressing and replacing their own imagery. The images are permanent. You can't get rid of them. You can't resist them. They're more powerful than personally created images. You turn into the images that you carry, and you believe what you see. Now, that's a dangerous arrangement. Now, I want to say a couple more things about kids, and then finish, because there's a couple more points to make about the relationship to children that reveals something about all of our relationship. I've mentioned a couple things about it, which is that it suppresses the imagination by replacing its own imagery. Unlike with books, for example, where your imagination is stimulated, or with radio where some imagination is stimulated. There's another thing, though, that's interesting to talk about. Well, let me mention one more before I forget it, which is that the Australians also showed that television induces and encourages hyperactivity in children. This is an important point because most people think that television is what you put. If you have a hyperactive child, you put that child in front of television, and then the child is calm. But what happens is the television goes off, and then the child goes wild again. And the Australians decided that television causes the hyperactivity. And here's how it works. You're sitting there watching television. People are punching each other on the screen. Something amazing is going on the screen. There is the impulse to respond to the thing that's on the screen. But it's television, so you suppress the impulse to respond. Then there's the impulse to respond again. Then there's the suppression of the response. Then there's the impulse to respond. Back and forth on that response suppression thing, and then the set goes off, and then blah. You know, wild, disoriented kind of behavior. And let's see how I do this here. It's also related to another element here, which is very, very important. In the United States, I've begun to use a term called loss of downtime in the United States, meaning that there's something being lost from children's lives in the United States because of their relationship to television. And I understand that kids here, too, have an important relationship to television, and that programs like Sesame Street, for example, which are shown on television here, which I think is, in many ways, a dangerous program, not having to do with the content. Which is, in America, I mean, I'm pre-television myself. I can remember before there was television, and I remember coming home from school every day and having a sandwich or playing with a dog, and then there'd be nothing to do. It would be boring. I would have to sit around figuring out what I was going to do, or else I would just, I don't know, flake out or something, but it was sort of there was a bottoming out that took place during that time. There was a time, in a way you could think of it as the wellspring of creative activity, because at some point you say, I'm going to do something, and then you start some activity. You call somebody, or you go outdoors, or, you know, you do an act of some kind, which is something. What happens now is when most American kids come home from school, the television set goes on. There's a lot of programming on for kids. Some of it is all right, some of it is not all right, you know, it's all kinds of programming. But now what happens is they turn on the television set and they never have to deal with that bottom moment, with that boredom, or with that bottom time, you might think of. So we're raising a generation of kids in America who don't experience their own boredom. And that leads, of course, to desiring, I think that's a drug relationship. You know, that's a relationship whereby the television set is used as the drug to calm that anxiety which may be coming along if you don't have the drug. But there's some important things to say about the drug, which is, you know, leads me back to the people's reports before, which is that most people think of television if it's a drug. A lot of people are willing to think of television as a drug. But most people think of it as Valium. Do you have Valium here? I hope so. You do. Because the way it zaps the brain, it makes everybody sit there, you know, staring like that, and it looks like Valium. I think the drug is speed. I don't think it's Valium. Or maybe it's both speed and Valium simultaneously, which is a very dangerous combination. Because when you're watching television in this pacified mental mode, the images, and it's the example of the hyperactive television causing hyperactivity, and the images are so fast. The images are very, very fast on television, and they've also been edited and fooled around with to such an extent, as I've talked about, that the perceptual universe of television is much faster than the perceptual universe of anything else in life. Then the set goes off, and then there's just a room. The room is slow. And then if you want to go out to nature, for example, nature is barely happening at all. It's very hard to see anything going on in nature. And, I mean, you really have to be slow to experience nature. And there's also got to be some nature somewhere for you to experience it. And then increasingly there isn't any available. So you move from that speeded up perceptual world, which has... And then you try to deal with a world which is in ordinary time, or so-called real time, and you don't have the equipment to do it, you know, or you're not trained to do it anymore, and you lose feeling for it. It's alienation. This is alienation. It's alienation from the world, or if I dare say, reality. Let's drop reality, whether that's an alienation from reality. So back to the television set, and you get back up to speed again, and everything calms out again, and everything's all right. So then video games have come along now. I have noticed quite a few video games here in the city, but they're not as extensive as they are in the United States, where they're everywhere. And all kids are playing video games a lot. And what they're doing with video games is they're speeding up to the electronic speed physically. Television speeds them up in the perceptual system, and the video games speed them up physically. So what you have to do is you have to go at the rhythm of the video game. You have to respond to the video game at its determined, it determines the speed of your response, and you have to get where you're not any longer thinking about your response, but you are just in tune with that machine. You and the machine have merged, and then you're good at it. If you can totally tune into the speed of that machine, and it's very, very fast, and there's no thinking involved, and it's a real wired connection. And then there's the world again, and the world is slow, and it's very hard to relate to things in the world after that. Okay, well, I'll skip some of this other fascinating stuff here. And let me just summarize by saying that there's so much more to say, and I've done more than my time that I wanted to do already. And I want to allow everybody else to speak. So it was only after I had worked on this for 4 or 5 years that I ever got the idea to speak about the elimination of television. I didn't start to write the book with that in mind. I never thought, I was writing a political book about television's effect on political movements in the United States, and what the meaning of the existence of television in political terms was. Well, that's still in there, but that now is a relatively smaller part of the book, and there's many, many other kind of points in there. And it was only at the very end that I said, this is rotten, this is bad, this is not a good medium, why do we have this? We'd be better off without this. We've been sold the idea that this is a progressive development in communications, and everybody from the left to the right, politically speaking, sees it opportunistically, sees it as something they can now use or put their message out. So there's this war going on among everybody for access to the medium, and all other categories of people wish to have access to artists and Indians and other people who don't usually get access wish to have it. And there's the general view of it that the machine itself is benign, that it's just a window through which things pass, and that it has no... I mean, McLuhan said the medium is the message, and we still don't want to listen to that. He said other things I disagree with, but that's a really important statement. And Langdon Winner in the United States has a very good book where he discusses the politics of artifacts, you know, the facts that things have politics, that things have meaning, that they have meaning in and of themselves, and you have to learn what it is if you really want to have it. First of all, you have to decide if you want to have it. It just came along. Nobody decided if they wanted to have it. Maybe in Holland there was a vote, I don't know. But So I sent a researcher, when I began to think, I think I'd rather not have television, I think I'm going to say that. So I sent a researcher to the library and to look up other books that may have taken that position. And she found that 6,000 books had been written in English about television since 1945 to 1976. 6,000 books about television, and not one of those books had even introduced that possibility. That no book had described no television, or that was a plausible point. No book had ever said, "What if we didn't have television?" Or maybe we better not have television. No book seriously discussed that point. Now, what is so hard about that idea? Why do people get so nervous and excited at that thought? I mean, usually the first time people hear that idea, they laugh at it. And the second time, it makes people anxious, and then they want to refute it, which is why I told everybody to relax about it at the beginning, so that you'd all just listen to what I'm saying. And I'm also not even saying here. I'm just asking, what is the charge in that subject? And I think it's, you know, just that we just are really not trained to ever being able to say no to a technology, and we also have no tools for evaluating it. We're not in that habit. Technology, mass technology, is real new. I mean, we've had advanced technology, you know, since the 1800s, but it's rapidly spurted forward into new dimensions of scale only very recently, only in the last two generations. But so we don't know how to think of it. We're not used to thinking about it. And there's no evidence that we can stop it. There's no evidence there's even any point in thinking about it. And we all like it, besides. We're interested in the machinery, and we want to get hold of it, and we want to use it for our purposes. But what does it mean about a democratic society if the subject is not raised at all? You know, what does it mean if we don't allow that argument to take place about it? Or if we don't want to include no in the spectrum of possibilities, it means that you get yes every time. It means you are absolutely subject to the technological processes as they're created by commercial interests, almost always. That's who creates them to make money with. I remember speaking not long ago to a group of Marxists in Berkeley, very enlightened people, who were, after I finished, one said to me, actually, the arguments that you make are very, very good, and almost everybody in the room will certainly agree with you, but we realize that that's never going to happen, and therefore, let's get talking about how we can use it in a better way. And so I was really surprised when that was the first question, the first point that was raised from this particular group, because this group is interested in the dismantling of the United States government and its replacement by a completely other political system, and they believe that it's plausible and achievable, but they think that to discuss getting rid of television is an absurdity, or totally not achievable. And it's got more power than anything else does. I guess I'll just say that, one more point, the one that you raised. Is that what you want to do? Or you want me to stop now? What are you saying? It's good to, okay. I'll leave it to anybody to speak or ask at this point. That's enough. People wanted to ask probably the question I said these other people asked first, so now I probably stopped everybody. Excuse me.
While I accept your reasoning for the argument, why no television in the world, I think you're perhaps trying to convince us, or at least telling us about your ideas for no television and getting rid of it, is perhaps based on your experience in the United States, and you quoted research done in the United States and right. In Australia, two countries which, to some extent, have something in common, television-wise, commercial television certainly. Is it fair then to say that there is no good, no negative or positive influence that television can have for here in Europe, the systems are quite different.
Right. First of all, I never say there's no good in television. I think there's good in many technologies which we ought to get rid of. I think there's good in genetic engineering. You know, it may solve some diseases, but it also mechanically recreates human beings. It's a fundamental change in everything. You could argue that there's some good in nuclear power plants because they provide energy and there's scarce energy available in other ways. But I think that on balance, the problems with nuclear energy are so great that we're better off without it. And in fact, there's a movement afoot to get rid of nuclear energy and nuclear armaments and everything nuclear. It's, in a way, the first example of a movement against a whole technology. The movement is now against the entire species of nuclear technology. So I think there's good things on television. I myself have seen good things on television. That's not the argument that I make. The argument that I make is whether on balance we're really better off with television or without it. And that's the only way I can ask people in Holland or anywhere else to address that question. Now, I made a little list of ways in which I think television is, or maybe I'll do this instead. You know, the assumption that television adds something to the communications, to knowledge of people, the amount of information people have, or that it's a positive good in terms of overall information, I'd like to say that I think that's a doubtful assumption. And here's why. Television is always celebrated for its ability to, for its simultaneity and its mobility, you know, that it can show a thing happening somewhere else. But actually, radio is a much better medium for simultaneity and mobility. If there's a thing that's happening in the world now that we must know about, radio is far better equipped to get it to us quicker and more accurately than television is, because it's a less expensive medium, more people can make radio, its transmission process is simpler, it also allows images to operate, so it's not a suppressing medium, but that's another dimension. If you really need to have an image to understand something, then film is a better medium. It's a much more refined technology. It's got much better imagery. Television imagery is probably the coarsest image that exists in artificial imagery, or in any imagery. Film imagery is much better at detail. It's also, the widescreen in itself produces some eye movement and thinking patterns going on. The process of going to a film is usually a process of a social act of some kind. You usually go with other people and you decide to go and it's not followed by the next thing in the form of its presentation. It's over and you ordinarily will discuss it. There'll be a discussion about it or you go have a coffee or something and talk over the experience. If there's detail, if there's depth required, real knowledge required, then print media is much better. It's not limited in time. It's able to produce imagery. It's able to explain things in very great detail, much greater detail than film or television is. It's pretty hard to think of what television really does that other media can't do, except that it provides sight and sound simultaneously into the home, so that it reaches everybody simultaneously, has that potential to do that. And it, but really, the way that really comes out, the people that's an advantage to, are really, that particular distinction of television is really only an advantage to the people who operate television. So I would doubt, first of all, that television is really a progressive move at all. I mean, I want to at least question the assumption that things really, that this is an advance of some kind over previous information modes. I think it's not. But as to whether the experience in Holland or England or Germany, where I understand they have interesting television, because it's different from the American experience, is for everyone else to decide. I mean, I'm sure your inclination is to think that it's different enough so that the arguments don't apply. But I would just ask, what is the relationship to people in the society to television? How much television do they watch in each of these places that I've named? Does it have real power? If it does have real power, it's in service to whom? How would you decentralize it? How could you make it so that it's more democratic? Is it achievable or is it not achievable? Maybe it doesn't have the scale of power it does in the United States, or maybe it does. Maybe, I mean, I read about this Moluccan person who took over Dutch television one time to send a message out through the media, and we've seen many such things in Germany, and some in England. It seems to have a similar king-making power. It seems to be where the news is. It seems to be where the energy moves through society. It seems to be the center of interest in all of these places. It may not be to the same extent. In Holland, I know that the style of the imagery is very simple. It's very similar. You know, it's a similar kinds of programs, the similar presentation of information. So the technical things are similar.
Can I just ask you, I mean, you're talking about not being able to see how it's progressive medium. Well, I'd quite like to ask you in a bit more detail how specifically you see it as regressive. Because the implications of people who talk about TV, and you as well, I mean, McLuhan, you quoted 1984, have been towards greater and greater uniformity.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if you look around, you don't see that at all. I mean, I don't think there's ever been an age where you could characterize it so much as an age of eclecticism, in fact, where there's less uniformity than there's ever been before. I mean, if you looked at a room like this, say, before there was television, you'd probably see a room full of people in suits. You know, so exactly, I don't quite see how the Big Brother is operating to the extent that you say it is, because it seems to me that people don't have any less choice now, that people aren't so totally less creative, that people's minds aren't so less attuned. I mean, I don't really see that television's got destructive, unifying power that you're suggesting.
What do other people think about that? I mean, I know, but I've said that I think that it is it's creating a sameness of mind, a sameness of culture. I'm saying that the act of watching television for long periods of time produces a certain kind of person with certain kinds of experiences, and television presents some broad, some deeper information in some areas. I think that overall the effect of television in terms of the total information flow is that people are getting a greater input of a certain kind and quality of information and less of an input from other media which had more diverse information and from non-media which had other kinds of diverse information. Now, if you're saying that things are more diverse and more decentralized, and people are more...
There's no orthodoxy. But if you look at a time before television, like, say, the Middle Ages, you had an orthodoxy, which was the church, you know, which told people what to believe, and people, by and large, went along with it. Well, there's no substitute for that. There is no orthodoxy, which everybody goes along with. If you go to university now, nobody will tell you the truth. They'll tell you a number of possible truths from which you have to choose. But surely the implication of what you're saying, the power of the media, it's quite the opposite. If what you're saying is true, there should be some one orthodoxy that everybody's going along with, and that plainly isn't the case.
Well, my observation in the United States, certainly, is that there is an enveloping orthodoxy that is tangible and visible, and you can just see it by showing up there. And it may be that people are wearing different clothing styles, but people are living within a certain kind of form of life. For example, you can go to any small town in the United States. Once you get out of New York City, San Francisco, Boston, and one or two others, you go to any small town and life is lived in a mall in the United States, in a shopping mall. All communications in a town, all gathering of people together in a town, which used to be done in a variety of ways, is now done at a mall. In other words, they're completely artificially created environments that people are spending their time within. If a mother wants to have her kid kill 3 or 4 hours worth of time, she will drop the kid at the mall, and the kid will play video games and run around the mall, live within the commercial structure. That's community life in the United States. Now, people's discourses, what most people talk about, is information that they get from television. Now, it may be things are real different here in Europe. And I haven't been around very much in Europe, and not for 7 years. So you may be right, and I may be totally off the wall here, but if what you're saying is that there's much greater diversity in Europe because of television,
or in spite of television,
then I don't know whether that's right or wrong. That's really up for all you to... I can't answer that. Okay, let's let some other people talk here. This is not a, in some ways, this is a fairly elite group in some ways. I mean, I don't know that the people that you contacted...
No, but even in a bar or a kind of very sort of semi-public situation, people just...
Didn't you notice in bars that people were always looking over your shoulder up at the television set?
No. I think this...
No. Okay. You next. You two. Cool. Well, what's happening now, I mean, that was an interesting conference. I know about that conference. And basically the conference was about how information movement in the world is basically dominated by Western industrial powers, mainly the United States. And as far as its relationship to so-called underdeveloped countries or less developed countries, what's happening now is, of course, satellite communications is coming in, and that's being very quickly used in all kinds of places it was never used before. And I've studied the example of Indonesia, and I know that there are many places in Indonesia which don't have roads, which have television operating many hours a day and inculcating people, and it goes along with artificial milk, you know, artificial Nestle chemical milk products, and it goes along with the attempt to put in people's heads, before even they're relating to the world, images of the world that's about to come and make it desirable. And it's monoculture as far as television. I mean, wherever television can operate that way, you're on the path to a much greater monoculturization than even exists at the present time. And that's mainly the way it's being used now. And there are some places where there's efforts to use it as an information system. In Cuba, there's the desire to try to communicate government programs in the village, on the village level, and have people understand them. But I think that's working out very badly, actually, also. Because if you really have information to pass through to people, it works much better if you do it personally or as a community than if it's sent through information central out to the villages, and I think they're abandoning that in many Cuban places right now, too. So that's the two sides of the story, I think. Yes? Yeah. Yes, you. Sensory cynicism.
That you would be that you would then have to have such self consciousness in looking at imagery that you found frightening. I would almost want to propose that that's the way we would want to educate people.
You have to if you want to keep the machine. If you accept the existence of the medium and you think that your children should relate to it, then you do have to... Well, there are people who do that. You know, the semiotics is one example of a system of understanding which tries to reveal the real meaning of what's going on. And there in the United States, there are these visual literacy programs that are going on where people are sending their kids to study visual literacy to try to understand what the meaning of an image is. Well, I use Brecht in my book, actually, as an example, and what he calls it is alienation is what he's, you know, theatrical alienation is what he speaks about, and I'm in favor of that as far as television is concerned, if you have television. I'm just saying that it's an illusion to believe that it's ever going to work out, that you're going to establish enough alienation from the medium, which is a medium which discourages an alienated view. I mean, it creates alienation in life, but it discourages alienation from itself, and it's an illusion to believe that we're ever going to succeed in training a population to interfere with their imagery in that way. And I think that why not accept that as a kind of problem? That instead of saying, well, what we've got to do is train people how to do it better, why not say, well, maybe this is an insurmountable problem, and that's just the way I look at it. You know, maybe when you add all many of these things up, you find an inherency in it. You find something which is inherent in the form, such as in nuclear power, there are inherent qualities, there's inherent modes of organization implied by nuclear power. You know, you need if you're going to have nuclear power, you need a high-tech government-military relationship to it. To protect people for the next 200,000 years. I mean, you immediately, automatically have a police state if you have nuclear power, or much, much more police arrangement. That's just inherent in the arrangement. It's because it can't be individually controlled. So I'm suspicious of any technologies which have the sort of scale so that these kind of problems arise. And, some people then say, well, then you're a Luddite. You're against all technology. But that's not true either, because, well, Marcuse, for example, to use Marxist arguments, wrote about how the optimum development level of technology it was in the early 1900s, around 1905, 1910. He said that's when technology advanced to the point where it could have been used best for society. It shouldn't have advanced beyond that into its present macro scale. People like Ivan Illich, whom some of you may have read, wrote that technology should have, that the optimal level of development was earlier than that, I think 100 years earlier than that. You know, Native Americans that I hang around with believe it was in the Pleistocene, you know, and that it should have stopped then, you know. I don't know where the line is. I'm just saying that there's a point at which some technologies or the evolution of technology itself may have advanced to where when you look at it totally from a democratic, from a point of view of participatory democracy, let's say, or real power over one's life, or community relationships or family relationships and so on, aside from what it does well, aside from the things that it can do, but when you look at it from a variety of what we call in California a holistic point of view, when you look at it from that point of view, then you can say, well, maybe we shouldn't have it. That's all I'm saying, you know. It's like, maybe we shouldn't have it. I think we shouldn't. And I don't really want to live in a world where everybody is so related to their machines, you know, where all, well, we've got to save television because we've got to, it's got this, we've got to make it better so we, because it's got a, maybe it could be used better. It's been around now for quite a while, and so far it hasn't been used better, and I can't imagine how it could be used better in a democratic form. And I can see little improvements of diversity of program or more kinds of people getting on it, but there's something about the nature of it which I think is going to mitigate it, create, it's going to cause immense problems however it's used, unless you didn't have broadcast at all. Unless you didn't have broadcast, you know, unless you only had video, let's say. I don't see video as a problem on that scale, you know. I never would have written a book about it if it was video. You know, I mean, I think artists using television is just fine. The problem with the problem is television going to exist on that scale? Get to you next. Yeah, I'm talking too much. Okay. Any other media? You could use it against all media. You could use it against books. You could, you know, and I think people should discuss all media. Well, it's created by the author. You know, I write a thing in a book, I get you to think something.
Yeah.
Yeah, slightly different, but it's based on my saying beach, for example. You can each come up with your own beach, but it's a beach you've come up with, and I've done it to you. So if there's a certain amount of centralization even in books. Right, so it's even more so. It's even more so. But the point is that you can make arguments about the problems with almost any medium. Radio was used in very fascistic ways in various places. It was used by Hitler with great effect. It was used by Roosevelt in the United States with great effect at the same time. And, you know, radio has potential autocratic problems. So all media creates a separation between the receiver and the sender, and it's a problem of control. But I don't think it's such a problem like television is. You know, I think it's a degree of scale, like certainly broadcast television. You know, it's a question of, you know, as I say, there's some line over which things cross at some point, and it's hard to define where the line is, but I think it's possible to know when something is over the line. You know, I think nuclear power is over the line. I think genetic engineering is over the line. I think television is over the line. Maybe cars are over the line. But, you know, it's what we have to learn to do is to look for the line, you know, or to articulate ways of talking about it. So it's possible to evaluate all media in these kind of terms. No, I just said I wouldn't have.
So, you say it's on the other side of the line. What are the arguments that this is wrong? What's the difference between books, newspapers, and television?
Well, I gave some of those differences already. I don't want to have to repeat them again, but there are a lot of differences between them, both in the way they're received and in the way they're controlled and in the nature of the interaction. And I think somebody could write such a book like that, but it's not me.
Something changed too. I mean, when books were introduced, there was a
Sure.
So you could write a book like that
yeah.
at that time.
Well,
so that's why
I don't know. People did, you know, people have written books about books, actually. I think there have been more books about books, the problems the printing press created, than have been critical of television in many ways. There certainly were a lot about radio. At the time when radio came along in the United States, there was highly critical material about radio, and in fact, a lot of it by Marxists, which was very interesting material. So, I mean, you can make these arguments, and you should make these arguments about all media, and then decide whether it's on balance better or worse, you know. And I don't think of it as nostalgia. I don't think of, I, for example, do not think of eliminating television as going back. I'm prepared to say it's going forward, because you know, you try. Part of the evolution of society is it tries things out, and if things that don't work out, it drops. And all we've got to do is figure out a way to be able to do that about technology, as we have about other things like incest or whatever. You know, we've got to be able to. You want incest. We've got to be, you know, I'm saying that it's moving forward to decide that something didn't work out and let's not have it anymore. I don't see it as nostalgic for something before. A society which has television and then doesn't have television or sharply restricts its function beyond what it is today will be moving forward. It won't be moving back to what existed before. Yes. You know, that was one of the things I meant to talk about, because in De Apple they said, well, now Mander's going to tell us how he's going to do it, or something like that. And I stopped the book right at the point of, well, how do you do it?
5 years ago.
And the reason I stopped it there then is because I thought it was enough to suggest that we should eliminate it. And that I didn't want the ideas to be judged according to whether my method was effective or not. I think the first step is put out that information, get people talking about it and thinking about it, get some agreement from people. I have some agreement already in the world from it. A lot of people. It's a very popular book in the States. And, you know, I can tell. Maybe I know everybody who's given up television personally. It's possible I do. But I get a lot of... You know, it's being used in colleges, it's moving around, and that's not achieving the elimination, certainly, but you have to start where you are. You start in a society where nobody had thought of it. It was an impossible thought. It's the kind of thought people didn't have. It was purged from consciousness to be able to think that way. So the fact of the book brings the possibility back just by its existence. Just by the fact that you have now heard me, and some of you have read the book, means that when you think about television, you've got to deal with it, what I'm saying. So before, you may disagree with it, but you can't just forget about this anymore. Now, as to how it actually is going to happen, television is not a module, you know, that you pull television out of the system and then everything else keeps functioning that way. Television is the nervous system in the United States. It's everything. It's what people do. It's everybody's wired to it. It's where all information, it's where the whole corporate society depends upon its existence to move products and information in a certain way at a certain time. So does the political structure. Television is now everything in politics in the United States. A candidate, it's no accident that an actor is president. And more former performers are running for office in the United States. But even if they're not performers, politicians in the United States are absolutely judged by how well they do on television. That is how they get to run. If they're good television performers, they're way ahead of everybody else. And the advertising money in the campaigns is all put on television. Television is it in political campaigns in the United States. And you can't pull that out and expect society to, you know, it's just not going to work like that. Television's got to be understood as one example. A particular kind of example, one that wires it all everything together. The one example of a scale of technology which is similar to nuclear power, which is similar to automated farming, or similar to automated pesticide being put on the plants, or similar to genetic engineering, or something. I keep using the same examples. No, there is a scale that's happening now in all in computers. You know, the computer world now is developing at such a scale that all of life is going to move through computers if it already hasn't. And then everyone has experienced computers at the same time. You know, what is lost by all that? You know, what kinds of things are changed as a result of that? So television has got to be seen as like the rest of it and part of the rest of it. And the solutions are going to be more radical than just the elimination of television. I mean, it's going to obviously go along the lines of a major decentralization of life and a major movement against technological form as it's evolved and the powers that be in relationship to that technological form. And it's also going to have to be argued from the point of view of people who are outside it, which is why I'm writing a book about Indians now.
Is it perhaps that your views are based on the fact that you think at home in the United States television has got out of control? It is under the control of your 100 corporations, which, from my little experience of Dutch television anyway, that doesn't seem to be a fear in this country. We can switch on our television sets and we can, in this so-called pluralistic society, can be bombarded with opinion from almost every angle. We don't have to go out and buy our 15 newspapers. We can't afford it. We can switch our television on and be stimulated by the discussion generated by these opinions, which doesn't induce an alpha state, I don't think.
Well, maybe you've got a great situation here in Holland. I don't know. Have all of you gotten to say your opinions on television? Or has your organization been able to do that? Before moving image media. They still believe what they see. But I'm saying that what they saw was a direct piece of information. In that case, now it's processed artificial information.
What about the juggler and the magician?
Well, a magician induces, attempts to induce confusion, that's true, but that's not a very popular example. But it's people try, there was magic and all kinds of things where people try to fool around with your image of reality, or maybe there's another reality, even in fact. But I'm saying, basically speaking, that was an example of people's dependency on their senses when that would happen too. Excuse me, go ahead.
Oh. No, it's not really a question. You were wondering what would happen if there was a television set in the room with your image on it. This reminds me of a kind of research being done in some schools where they had actually a television set teacher and the teacher live. Huh. And all the kids were watching the television. Then at a certain moment he had a friend come in and beat him up. And they were all fascinated by the show on television. They were all watching the screen and not helping him or so in any way. It's a typical sample of how it works.
My favorite image like that is an image of a photographer. It's not a television image, but it's an image of a photographer being photographed by another photographer as this photographer is photographing a man hitting another man with a club. So here's this photographer photographing the guy being hit with the club, and that photographer is photographing this photographer photographing that. Nobody's helping the guy. Somebody over there? Well, I suppose it's functions in some of that dimension. Yeah, I think it's people can get rid of it in their own lives right away if they want. Maybe in Holland it doesn't represent as much of a problem. I wish I knew more about Dutch television to know. I mean, I doubt that it's as democratic as it's been described by this man, and yet it's probably much more democratic than American television, and it's probably not as corporate controlled as American television. But is everybody sitting home watching their televisions, and is that the main mover of information, and is that the way people are experiencing their lives? And
it's increasing.
It's increasing? Is it increasing?
My opinion is it's increasing.
The effect is increasing?
Massive.
It's probably just not a workable arrangement. It's good for doing yoga, I hear. So, I guess that's it.
What? I read your book and I was overwhelmed.
Okay, thanks very much.